Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Counter, an NFL podcast from USA Today Sports.
Welcome to The Counter. We got Damian Woody this week, and it is a fantastic interview. Former Pro Bowl offensive lineman, won a couple of Super Bowls with the Patriots. He's actually stopping by to talk about the Jets and the Sam Darnold trade. It's a fantastic conversation. Stick around for that. I'm Chris Corman, joined by Stephen Ruiz and Charles McDonald. We cover the NFL for the win, and we're here to talk about whatever's going on in the league. Guys, what's going on?
I'm broken. Just mentally broken.
Steven is a Panthers fan. I don't know if we've mentioned that in our 80 episodes of The Counter or whatever it is, but
I'm kind of a Panthers fan. It's fading. I'm a Panthers fan in that I tolerate them more than the other 31 teams. I hate them less than I hate.
No, I actually think you hate them more.
Well, yeah, and that's why you're a fan.
Yeah, that's true.
Like that's like I look at like the hopelessly optimistic fans, and I'm just like, how do you live with yourself?
Yeah, I'm from Philadelphia, so I have no idea what that feeling is like. Sports is purely about feeling terrible when you grow up in Philly. So, but I mean, I noticed you fighting with people who are feeling optimistic about Sam Darnold, and Woody is one of those people. Like, we're going to get to that. He feels like Sam Darnold can turn this around. And then we're also going to let Steven discuss his quite thorough investigation into why there should be no hope.
I feel like Steven is kind of at a point, like our origin stories with our fandom are very similar, because like the first team that I ever fell in love with actually was that 2000 Baltimore Ravens team. And then next year, Michael Vick came into the league, and I was like, as a 7-year-old, like, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen in my entire life. So I'm going to root for the Falcons now. And then it's kind of like, you know, there's a whole generation of Panthers fans that are fans because of Cam Newton. Now, the difference is when Michael Vick left the Falcons, we only had 1 year of misery before we had Matt Ryan back in the fold. I don't know how long this stuff is going to be with the Panthers. Like, it's not quite exactly the same in the post-funk quarterback year. So we'll see what happens. I wouldn't be surprised if Steven's kind of off this narcotic in 2 years.
like I've said to other Panthers fans about Teddy Bridgewater, it's all like, I love Teddy. Everyone loves Teddy, right? Like, right. Everyone loves who he is.
The person.
But
yeah.
It's all fun and games until he's your quarterback. And then you're like, all right, this isn't so fun.
Now you got Sam Darnold. So.
And that's even worse.
All right. We'll dig in on that a little bit later. We're also going to talk about the little Twitter kerfuffle that popped up with the Bengals selection and whether they are better off drafting a lineman to protect Joe Burrow or a wide receiver to catch balls from Joe Burrow. So we're going to sort of wade into that debate in general, which one we think is more helpful. Not that there's a very clear answer, because it's football and it's complicated. But we want to start with, we've not addressed the Deshaun Watson situation. We have talked a ton about Deshaun Watson on this podcast as a sublime football player. We are huge Deshaun Watson football player fans, but I'm not going to speak for you guys, but I don't care if I ever see Deshaun Watson play football again. These are just accusations at this point. Obviously, Deshaun Watson is presumed innocent until proven guilty. But what we know, what has come out so far, the preponderance of body workers and the people that he is employed. I think the number is up to 22 that have filed civil suit. The Houston Police Department is now investigating his actions. He is losing sponsorship deals. It looks really bad. And if you watched the press conference with one of the women came forward, Ashley Solis was the first one on Tuesday, came forward and explained his actions. We've talked about Deshaun Watson as a football player, and I think we all thought that he was a decent person too. But I know that I wrote in probably 1999, 2000, I don't know about Jerry Sandusky being a good person. He cultivated that image for a long time to hide his predatory behavior. And what we're hearing about Deshaun Watson so far is it's hard to shake. It's really, really awful.
Yeah. I mean, I was, just to pull curtains behind what we talk about on a daily basis. I was talking to a good buddy, Patrick Claybon, the other day, and I was telling him, I was like, man, like, I feel kind of disappointed in myself in a way that I could get kind of swept up in the image of a guy. And like the first thought when I hear these, you know, the allegations for the first one, it's like, oh man, like, no way. Like Deshaun Watson, like, he would do that. You know, he comes across as this really good guy. And, you know, I guess covering football for, you know, almost 6-7 years now, I probably should have known a little better. But then Patrick made a good point to me. He was like, you know, like, you shouldn't feel too bad if you're someone that believed that Deshaun Watson was someone that couldn't do this, because at the information you had at the time made it seem like there's no way he could do something like this. And you just kind of have to adjust your information, your opinion of things as new information comes out. And I don't understand really how anyone could be defending Deshaun Watson right now based on what we know. I mean, we're talking about 22 civil cases. And based on what we know, it's not like women, like, they don't do this for shits and giggles, for lack of a better term. Like, it's not something that they just wake up and decide, like, oh, you know what? I'm going to extort Deshaun Watson today, of all people. You know, one of the most powerful people in the city of Houston, someone who's donated time and money to, you know, making people who are struggling make their lives better. I'm going to wake up today and I'm going to find 21 other women and we're going to get this civil case going. No, it doesn't work like that. Like, reliving these experiences is really painful. It's traumatic. And to think that someone would just be doing this for money is just kind of crazy. When you get down to, like, all the things you have to go through, like, you have to, we just saw two women come out in public and their lives are, like, ruined over
forever that. Changed.
Yeah. Forever changed. Forever. Right. So, you know, I just think that we need to get to a point where we have to believe that he absolutely could have done it. And honestly, when his lawyer was like, well, actually, well, we found 18 massage therapists that Deshaun didn't assault. I was like, well, that's not a very good defense, because now people are asking, like, why does this guy have, like, 50 massage therapists?
This is a point that's really important to make, is that pro athletes are not in the business of bringing new people into their lives on a frequent basis. You know, like, that is just not how any of this works. If you've been around pro athletes, they are incredibly picky about who gets to work on their body, who they're affiliated with, who they're sharing anything with. I mean, it's, you know, they get all, there's all sorts of training about this, right? Is to keep your circles close, to be careful about who you affiliate with. And the fact that Deshaun Watson very clearly, it seems, was scrolling through Instagram, trying to find women to set up new appointments with, it's just very outside behavior from what you would expect of a superstar in the NFL. And, you know, in addition to the 22 the 22 people that are filing the civil suits, I think Sports Illustrated, our friend Jenny Vrentis, found another person who was not involved with those lawsuits, and also came forward and she reviewed text messages. You know, there is substance to this. There are messages with Deshaun Watson saying, "I'm sorry it went that way." So there's a lot here.
And as Chuck alluded to, like, the defenses that they're coming up with are not good. Not just the fact that there were 18 more masseuses that he employed, but I think they tweeted out emails of correspondence with him and Busby, the lawyer representing these women. And he was trying to show that they were asking for money. They were asking for $100,000. And if you read the email, Deshaun Watson's lawyers or representatives are cooperating with it. They're like, "Oh, that's too much money, but maybe like we could bring that number down." Why would you participate in that discussion if this person was totally innocent? And it's just all these little red flags that add up to something sinister going on. And I, like Chuck said, I don't know how you could be defending him right now, but there are people defending him. There are NFL players defending him. A Raven safety was on Twitter defending him yesterday, and I just don't get it. And yeah, there's no way to talk about this situation that's good other than this is horrible.
Yeah
someone tweeted at me last night, like, being all snarky. They were like, "Hey bro, like, you haven't been tweeting about Deshaun Watson very much." I'm like, "Why do you think that? Like, of course not. Like, there's nothing good to say, and like, anything bad is like, it's just believe the women that's going on and then just wait and see what's going on till the end of the case." But
right,
it's so bad. And the crazy thing to me is, like, people still talking about his trade value.
Yeah. Can we pull up the dicks a little
bit? Also, I just want to say, I don't think that's fair to Chuck anyway, because I've seen you retweet stuff. I've seen you quote tweet stuff. Like, you have not ignored the situation. If anything, I felt guilty about how I have not talked about it, just because I'm uncomfortable talking about it. And it's not because I think Deshaun Watson is innocent or I'm like trying to protect him. I just don't know how to talk about it. But I've seen Chuck talk about it, so I don't even know where that characterization comes from. Wow. And another characterization that has come up that I don't get is these people claiming these women are just in it for a quick money grab. There's nothing quick about these situations. Like, this is, you know how much effort, how much emotional effort goes into this for these women? And it's going to be a long process. It's going to be drawn out. And like, you could point to that $100,000 number. Like, that's not a significant amount of money considering what you have to put into this emotionally.
Right.
And just,
and what the lawyer gets. I mean, like, it's just not like, these are not, if because that's what Watson's lawyer said, right? Is that, I think he accused Ashley Solis of just wanting money and asking for $100,000. Like, that's, I don't know how you look at that number and say, "Oh yeah, they're just money. They're just grabbing for the money." Also, it's important to note that it's not just in Houston too. Some of these accusations have come from other places. There's just no, like, I don't know how you look at this and immediately default to like, "Oh, this is a scheme to get Deshaun Watson." It just does not feel that way at this point, given how the story has unfolded and how much work has been done by reporters to dig into it. So, we will not be talking the whole, like, "Well, they still might trade it." Like, no team should be trading for Deshaun Watson at this point. We should not even be talking about that part of it. The NFL is investigating, you know, they have sort of their own side process, that under the personal conduct policy, but I can't even find a way to think about whether to care about whether or not Deshaun Watson plays football again anytime soon. It's just,
yeah,
not,
that's completely irrelevant. And just right. back to the quick point about Stephen's point about how much time it takes, like, the Antonio Brown civil case is still open, and right. That was what, almost 2 years ago. I think 2 years ago, like 2020 kind of warped my sense of time, but I think that was like almost 2 years ago. So anyone expecting this to be even finish by the start of the season is kind of crazy.
Right. All right. Let's transition over and talk to Damian Woody. We primarily are having him on to talk about the Jets. He has one of his most hilarious answers in this interview is we asked him why it comes at the end. We asked him why he ended up sort of becoming a talking head about the Jets when he in fact won Super Bowls with the Patriots. And it's the answer is that they need more help. And so, so we sort of dig in with him on what's next for the Jets and what he made of the Sam Darnold trade. It's a really fantastic interview. We're excited for you guys to hear it. So let's go over to that.
True crime lovers are always looking for new and engaging content.
The Already Gone podcast covers stories from Michigan and the Great Lakes region. Cases you haven't heard before, like the Mayo Hunters or the murder of 16-year-old Justin Mello. Plus, better-known cases like the death of Jane Bishara and Illinois' own Lori Dan. Already Gone started in 2016, so there is a big back catalog for you to enjoy. Find Already Gone on Apple Podcasts, Good Pods, or your favorite podcatcher.
And now we are joined by former NFL lineman and current ESPN NFL analyst, Damian Woody. What's up, Damian? Welcome to The Counter.
Hey, I appreciate you guys having me on.
So, Damian, if you don't follow him on Twitter, is an avid Jets fan, or I don't know if Jets fan is the right word, but talks about the Jets a lot. He used to play for them, was drafted by the Patriots back in the day. And if you've been following the NFL this week, you know that the Jets have been in the news with the trade, with Sam Darnold being traded to the Carolina Panthers for multiple picks. So we figured who better to bring on to talk about than that. So I guess we can just jump right in with the first question, which is like, are you surprised at all by Sam being traded? And are you surprised by the timing of the trade?
No, I'm not surprised by the trade at all. I think there's, you know, just been rampant speculation that, you know, that the Jets were going to, you know, move on from Sam Darnold and kind of hit that reset button as far as, a rookie quarterback and that rookie contract is concerned. And, you know, me personally, I always had an affinity towards Sam. I believe in his talent. I've always said that the organization definitely failed him as far as building around him. But obviously with Joe Douglas and new coach Robert Saleh, it was time to move in a different direction. I think it's a win-win for everybody involved.
What do you think about the compensation that the Jets got from Carolina? You think it was enough, too little? Because there's been some debate about like what they received on Twitter.
I actually think it was more than I thought they were going to get, considering this late stage in the game. I mean, because think about it. You know, it just seems like every week there was a new quarterback being moved. Another team was acquiring another veteran quarterback. So the destinations were drying up as to where you thought Sam Darnold could go. And, you know, this week I was just thinking, okay, maybe Carolina, maybe Denver, maybe Pittsburgh, you know, someone maybe that could sit behind Ben for 1 year and maybe get a shot. But the options have been limited. And for the Jets to basically get a 6 this year, a 2 and a 4 next year, I thought that was a coup for Joe Douglas. So, again, kudos to him to, you know, get that compensation. And now the hard part is you got to hit on the draft picks.
Hey, Damian, unfortunately, I'm a Panthers fan. It hasn't been too fun the last couple of years. And by the other side of the token, they gave up the 2nd and the 4th and the 6th for Sam Darnold. Can you give me a reason to be optimistic about this move working out? You said you were a Sam supporter. You thought the organization failed him. Do you think he's going to have a chance to succeed in Carolina?
I do. I do think he'll have a chance to succeed. There's a couple reasons why. Number one, I think people don't understand Sam Darnold is younger than Joe Burrow. Think about that. Sam Darnold, who's going to go into his 4th year, is younger than Joe Burrow, who's going into his 2nd year for the Cincinnati Bengals. He's only 23 years old. I mean, he literally came into this league as like, you know, just in terms like a baby. He's still learning and growing from the game. That's one. Number two, he's going to a much better organization. I think David Tepper, the owner, I think he's a really good owner. Matt Rhule, I am a huge fan of Matt Rhule. Recently, they never surrounded him with talent. The best talent that he had on offense with the Jets was Robbie Anderson, who's now with the Carolina Panthers. And look at the talent that they have down in Carolina, and will be able to add more with the number 8 pick. So I think Sam Darnold has an opportunity to really set himself up really well. The Carolina Panthers will surround him, and I think that's a great spot for him.
Do you think that the Panthers should go with an offensive player at 8 or stick with trying to rebuild that defense?
I think I saw that they're going to exercise his fifth-year option.
Right.
So I think if you're the Carolina Panthers, continue to build around the quarterback. You made the trade. You gave up 3 assets to acquire him. Keep building. You know, I just think I don't know how the draft is going to fall. But imagine if you get a guy like Kyle Pitts, a tight end, to go along with the other weapons that they have offensively, or another offensive lineman because they need to address the offensive line in this draft. They got to continue to build around the young quarterback. And I think that's what they'll do.
So let's say the Panthers are sitting at 8, and I don't know if this is going to happen, but Trey Lance, Justin Fields, one of those two slips to number 8. What do you do if you're Carolina? Do you think about taking that quarterback, or are you just gung-ho with Sam this year? Draft another weapon or an offensive lineman.
I think this is what you do. I think that if one of those quarterbacks is there and a team is looking to move up, I think you gotta entertain trading down. I think if you're Carolina, you entertain trading down. I don't think you need to pick a quarterback. I think you gave up 3 assets to get him. And I know he's not expensive or anything like that. But I think that if you're going to be in on Sam Darnold, then go all the way in on him. Add more players around him to see what you really have in Sam Darnold.
If you were trying to sell, like someone, let's say we're talking to a Panthers fan that doesn't know much about Sam Darnold, like what would you tell them to get excited about Sam coming to Carolina?
Well, I think that Sam Darnold is one of the most naturally talented throws of the football that I've seen in this league. I understand people, you know, talk about the turnovers and all those type of things, but anyone who's watched the Jets play, you'll see a lot of situations where you're like, wow, like the places that he's able to put the ball, not a lot of guys can do that. He's mobile. He's an athlete. I mean, this was a guy that has like a linebacker's mentality at the quarterback position. He's not a small guy. He plays with a linebacker mentality. So he's ultra competitive. He's even keeled. When you play in New York, you're under the pressure cooker all the time. This is a guy that's always even keeled. So I think, you know, for fans out in Carolina, that's exactly what you're looking for out of your quarterback.
Damien, you mentioned how much pressure there is playing in New York. Well, what do you think the realistic expectations would be for Zach Wilson if he, in fact, is the QB of the future for the Jets?
Well, I think Zach Wilson is going to be walking into a totally different scenario, situation than when Sam walked in with the Jets, because now Zach Wilson be walking into a situation where you have the GM and the coach basically married at the hip. This is not some, you know, shotgun marriage that the Jets have done for the past decade plus. This is literally the GM hiring the coach. They're both married at the hip. And the Jets have a ton of draft capital to really surround a young quarterback. And the roster's already upgraded offensively from when Sam Darnold was on the team. So I just think that it's a totally different situation for Zach Wilson.
How do you think that Zach will fit in Mike LaFleur's offense? I mean, I'm not sure how much you studied of like what the 49ers would do, but just from the surface, like it seems like it would be a pretty nice fit for him walking into this offense year one.
Well, I think it's a perfect fit, to be honest with you. I think for his skill set, a guy that can make throws on a run, who's accurate with the football, processes information really, really well. He's an athlete. I think it's perfect because what the New York Jets, this offense under Mike LaFleur, They want to be a run and run play action type of offense. They want the passing game to marry with the run game. And so I think that's going to fit perfectly with what Zach Wilson like to do, because he's such an accurate guy, particularly down the field. And that's what the Jets want to do this year.
For people who don't know, when you say marry the passing game with the run game, like what do you mean by that?
Yeah. What that means is, like, when you have your run game, you have certain run plays, you know, in a Kyle Shanahan, Mike LaFleur type of offense, a lot of it is outside zone run. And so what you're going to see is the Jets are going to run that. They're going to run that scheme, but they're also going to have the passing game that's going to look just like the running game. So there's going to be play action that's going to look like outside zone, but it's a play action pass. And that's how you create huge chunks in the passing game when your run and your play action pass both look the same.
So there's been a discussion, it's mostly on Twitter, about play action and the relationship between a run game and play action. And the stat nerds have kind of shown that you don't have to actually establish the run to have an effective play action game. You were an NFL offensive lineman. You could feel linebackers and linemen reacting to the run. What is your opinion on that debate?
Well, I mean, the numbers do bear it out. So I'm a little old school where, you know, you want to control the line of scrimmage early. But we also know the best down to pass is what? First down.
Mm-hmm.
First down is usually the best down to pass on. And that's what you see a lot of the good teams, particularly like the Tennessee Titans. They do it a lot, you know, over the past few years with Ryan Tannehill. Play action pass on first down and gain huge chunks of yards. Obviously, you got the running game going, but I think what you're going to see from the Jets is you're going to see a lot of play action pass, not just on, you know, second or third down. You're going to see it on first down a lot, which you hardly ever saw Adam Gase do with the New York Jets.
Yeah, moving away from the quarterback position, I think that one person that Jets fans are really excited about is Mekhi Becton moving forward. Like, how do you see him fitting in this offense? Because, you know, he's a big dude, and I guess people haven't quite seen him play in a heavy outside zone system all that much. And how good do you think that he can be just when it's all said and done with his career?
Yeah, well, actually, he ran that type of system at Louisville, University of Louisville. So this is going to be something that's it's not new to him. It's something that he ran in college, so it's perfect for him. Listen, I think I've said many a times about Mekhi Becton, I think the sky's the limit. I think he has Hall of Fame potential, and it's just going to be all on him. I thought he had a really good first year. He had a couple injuries, missed a couple games, and I think he, you know, be able to clean that up. But I think he's a perfect fit for what the Jets want to do. The Jets want to be, you know, a physical group. They want to run the foot. They're going to want to run the football this year. Again, you know, run, play action, pass. And when you have a physical guy at the point of attack like Mekhi Becton, that's going to help not only in the run game, but in pass protection, knowing that Zach Wilson will have the comfort of a franchise left tackle keeping them clean.
So I think everyone on here liked the Jets offseason. I thought they did good work. But one thing they didn't do is find a new center. How much is that going to hurt them, particularly in this system where it seems like center is such an important position, like Kyle Shanahan getting Alex Mack this year. They got him when he was in Atlanta too. Is that something they're going to need to find before they can really get this thing going? Or do you think they can work around whatever deficiency they might have at that position this year?
Well, I think Connor McGovern is actually, I think he's pretty good. The main problem with the Jets last year or the past few years has been in the interior as far as the guards are concerned. Their guard play has been horrible over the past couple years. So I think what you'll see from the Jets in the draft, again, the Jets have a ton of draft capital. They're going to attack the interior of the offensive line. This draft this year, particularly the offensive line, is deep. So the Jets will have a lot of opportunities to really get some really good, talented guys along the interior and solidify the interior of their offensive line.
I guess one more question about the Jets that I had for you. We saw a lot this offseason where guys who signed contracts with the Jets, especially Carl Lawson, I think Justin Hardy, the special teams guy they signed, they cited Robert Saleh as the reason that they wanted to come to the Jets. Like, I'm not sure if you've spoken to Saleh, but what about him is just, you know, makes people want to come here and be around him?
Yeah, I haven't spoken to him yet. You know, I'm sure he's pretty busy and he's had a lot going on, but I'll definitely get around to speaking with him. But from everything that I've heard from talking to guys around the league and coaches, this guy, he gets it, man. He's a player's coach. He knows how to talk. He knows how to talk to his players. He knows how to address them. He knows how to get the most out of his guys. He's flexible. We've seen that with the San Francisco 49ers when he was the defensive coordinator. His scheme was flexible. And I think the biggest thing that he's going to bring to the New York Jets is culture, because that's what's been missing for years with the New York Jets. The culture really hasn't changed since Rex Ryan was the head coach of the Jets. And that's what this Jets organization needs, is someone who can be the face of this team, who can bring a culture. And I think that's what Robert Saleh is going to bring, similar to like what Pete Carroll has done with the Seattle Seahawks, because he coached under Pete Carroll in the early part of his career.
So you played for Bill Belichick early in your career, and he's kind of, at least publicly, our perception is he's on the other end of that spectrum, where he's not necessarily a rah-rah guy. I'm wondering, as a player, does the type of coach you want change throughout your career? Like, maybe you want that rah-rah guy when you first start out, and maybe you want more of a X's and O's guy, or a guy that's going to be able to give you information that helps you be a player. How does that change throughout your career?
Well, I'll tell you one thing. For me, I was fortunate. I experienced both ends of it. Mm-hmm. My rookie year in New England, Pete Carroll was actually my coach. He drafted me in New England. And so I got a taste firsthand of the culture with Pete Carroll, which is great. It's won Super Bowls. And then I got a taste with Coach Belichick, who's on the other end of the spectrum. And that was great. And that won Super Bowls. So, you know, for me, I know during my playing days, I've always said I'm thankful that I kind of started in my career with Coach Belichick, because he was tough. He was hard-nosed. But he taught me so much about the game of football, and he laid that foundation for me for the rest of my career. And then I ended up with Rex Ryan, who was just perfect, because I already knew how to play the game of football. I already knew how to be a pro and take care of myself. Rex Ryan was a guy that, like, you guys know Rex Ryan, just watch him. I mean, Rex Ryan is a braggadocious, like, he doesn't look at himself as a head coach. He looks at himself as just one of the guys. And it was perfect. And we had a lot of success in New York during my playing career under Rex. So I like both styles. It's both styles at work, and we'll see how it does in New York.
We can move on to a couple of fan questions. I think the first one is from one of the million Jets fans that follows me. It's from Gary V, at Gary the New Yorker on Twitter. Do you think this reset with Wilson, or whoever, in quotes, will be different than what the Jets did with Darnold, and why or why not?
I do. I do think it'll be different. And you know, just like I said earlier, I think the organization is on the same page. Unlike when Sam Darnold first came, you had the arranged marriage. This time around, you had the GM and Joe Douglas hired the head coach. So they're married at the hip. The Jets also have they got a ton of cap space and a ton of draft capital, so they can really build around a quarterback. And to me, those are the things that separate this time around from when Sam Darnold came with the Jets.
Next question from Jason Hewitt, at Jason Hewitt 50 on Twitter. What was your quote-unquote welcome to the NFL moment?
Oh, man, I remember my first training camp, and I was going up against a guy. You know, I'm a first-round pick, number one pick for the New England Patriots. I'm going against a guy. His name is Henry Thomas. And just to give you a background, Henry Thomas. Henry Thomas was one of the best nose tackles in the history of the game. I mean, this was a guy who was like 270 pounds and had like 100 sacks or close to 100 sacks. And he mentored a bunch of guys, especially with the Minnesota Vikings during that time. And I remember our first practice, man, he literally with one hand, I was 335 at the time. He literally with one hand lifted me off the ground and threw me to the ground. And I'm like, damn, it never happened to me before. And that was my welcome to the NFL moment. But the cool thing was he taught me how to play the game. He helped me every day in practice. And I'm forever indebted to Henry Thomas.
Going off your time with the Patriots, this is my own fan question. I was younger, but I remember there being talk about in between the AFC Championship game and that Super Bowl against the Rams, there was talk about who was going to start at quarterback, Bledsoe or Brady. You being in the locker room, was there ever a sense that it was going to be Bledsoe, or did you guys know it was going to be Brady the whole time?
We knew it was going to be Brady. I mean, listen, we had time between, but we knew, you know, Tom was on the mend. He was going to heal up, and anyone that knows Coach Belichick knows that he's not going to divulge any, you know, he's not going to give away any information that's going to tip anybody off. And we just kept things close to the vest. And one thing about the New England culture, if it's not about your injury, you're not going to talk about injuries, period. Not your own and definitely not someone else's.
If Mo Lewis doesn't hit Bledsoe like that, do you guys still win the Super Bowl? Like, do you think you guys had enough around the quarterback position?
Mo Lewis changed the organization, changed two organizations.
He changed Drew Bledsoe's kidney, too.
I don't know if there ever is a dynasty in New England.
This next question is from JP Acosta on Twitter, at Acosta32_JP. Who is your favorite defensive lineman, not on your own team, to play against in the NFL?
Wow. Man, I went against some really, really good guys, man. Really good guys. I would probably say Warren Sapp was a beast. I mean, this dude was like 6 foot, 300 pounds, and was about the quickest guy I've ever gone against, man. And man, he would let you know about it all day too. So for me, I would have to say Warren Sapp.
This question, one of our second last question from our buddy Deontay Lee at PFF_DLee on Twitter. Which city was more fun for you during Super Bowl week, New Orleans or Houston, or can you not say why?
Well, listen, we were on lockdown both times, but I would have to say New Orleans. New Orleans was crazy. I can't even get into all the stories and stuff like that, but New Orleans, I would give New Orleans the edge. They know how to do it right in New Orleans.
All right, and the last question is from me. You won two Super Bowls with the Patriots, but it seems like on Twitter, all you really talk about is the Jets. Why do you seem to identify more with the Jets when you had more, you know, success, I guess, like team success in New England?
Because I look at it as New England, what does New England need me to do? Like, they've won six Super Bowls. Like, they've been to nine. I look at myself as, listen, the Jets need all the help they can get. I try to, Jet fans seem to understand where I'm coming from when I do my vents and all those type of things. It's almost therapeutic to Jets fans. So, but in all seriousness, like, I really have a lot of respect for both organizations for different reasons. And I just think because I live in the New York tri-state area that I talk about the Jets more than I talk about the Patriots because I watch the Jets more.
I'm taking from that the Lions are just a lost cause and you're just not going to waste your time with that.
Yeah, like, I don't even – like that 4 years doesn't even get discussed. Like, I don't even discuss that in my house or anything like that.
Was Dan Orlovsky on your team?
Yeah. Then, yeah. Yep. Yep. Dan Orlovsky. I was teammates with Dan Campbell, the head coach there now. Like, yeah, it was bad, man. It was bad.
All right,
it was traumatic.
One last thing, the Dan Campbell quotes that we saw at the presser. Personally, I thought that people were kind of making too big a deal about that. But was he like that in real life? Like as a player, when you guys were around him, was he talking like that too?
Yeah, like that's totally him. So like when I heard it, I'm like, that's nothing new, nothing crazy. That's Dan Campbell. Like he's like Dan is like a totally good dude. Like he's all about ball all the time. So yeah, I think as much as people bash like the comments and the quirkiness of the comments, I think he's put together a hell of a staff.
Yeah,
I think he'll do all right in Detroit.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that like people kind of flipped on. Like at first when he had the press conference, everyone was laughing about the comment, the biting the kneecaps comment. But then he started making hires and he was hiring black coordinators too, which I think everyone commended. And some of his other comments, just like, I think people have done a 180 on him. And now I'm kind of excited to see what he does with this Lions team. Do you think he has a chance of doing the impossible and turning the Lions into a consistent winner?
I think he does, man. I think he has a pedigree. He kind of, he learned his chops under Parcells with the Dallas Cowboys. And then Sean Payton, he spent all the time with Sean Payton down there in New Orleans. So he has a pedigree. I think he's surrounded himself with some really good people, some smart people. I could totally see it happening.
All right. We appreciate the time. Before we let you out here, is there anything that you're working on or stuff that you're on that you want to let people know about?
Man, I'm all about this draft right now. I'm just excited, to see what's going to happen with the draft. And, for anybody who wants to check me out on social media, whether it's Twitter, Instagram, it's at Damian Woody. And check me out. Check me out on ESPN on the various platforms.
All right. Appreciate it, Woody. We'll catch up with you later.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Steven, you were incredibly polite in that conversation as you were talking to Damian Woody about your thoughts of whether or not there's any chance for Sam Darnold to resurrect his career with the Panthers. And Damian, he's got some optimism, man. He feels good about it. Were you persuaded at all by what you heard there?
No, obviously not. I get
you had dug in on a lot of numbers though beforehand. So to be fair, like you really studied this problem. Damian Woody is probably looking at Sam Darnold like the person and hoping that he can have this. But you have really looked at what Darnold, the quarterback, has done on the football field. So
I think Damian is. Yeah, like you said, the person, I think he probably has a personal attachment. He's probably met Sam before. He's probably talked to him before. Like, I don't have any of those connections. But it's just, like, I legitimately tried to find some sliver of optimism about this trade when I wrote this blog about Sam Darnold and whether the Panthers can fix him. And, like, you just can't find it other than those highlights that he gives you once every month. And the thing is, when you look at the things he's supposedly good at, and I really think the perception of who Sam Darnold is so far off from what he actually is if you watch him on a snap-to-snap basis. Like, he's got this reputation as a gunslinger because he turns the ball over a lot, but if you watch him play within structure, he's really conservative. Like, he checks the ball down a lot. And he's really only good at those shorter passes, like, accuracy-wise. I cite it Pro Football Focus, and it shows that he is way below average at every other type of throw. But if you throw in like behind the line of scrimmage throws, like screen passes, swing passes, he's accurate as hell on those.
Right.
And I think that's why Adam Gase's offense looked as conservative as it did. Now, I'm not taking any fault away from Adam Gase. He's a bad coach. His offense is not great. He did not help Sam Darnold develop at all. But it goes both ways. Like, Sam Darnold on his own was bad. And that's what's so hard to reconcile as a Panthers fan who's trying to be optimistic about this team. It's really hard to do it because there's no evidence. It's just a leap of faith.
Right. I mean, the fact that you found that, like, essentially what you did was look at the numbers and you found that Joe Flacco executed the offense better than Sam Darnold did. Like that's the bit of evidence for me that was like erased all, because like every team who gets a new player like wants to think that that player can be healed and can become the best version of themselves and that there was something holding them back. And like if you can't erase that thought, like I'm sure that that's how Colts fans are feeling about Carson Wentz right now. They're just like sure that the best version of Carson Wentz is going to be the permanent indie version of Carson Wentz and like whatever they're doing to justify that. But like I don't know how Panthers fans can still feel that way after what you found and wrote about what actually happened on the football field.
and Chuck could speak to this because he actually watched these games more more closely than I did, having covered the team. But like it wasn't just that Flacco performed better statistically. He was more exciting on a down-to-down basis because he was airing the ball out. Like he had like the highest average depth of target in the league. And Sam Darnold was on the other end of the spectrum. Like Panthers fans got tired of check down Teddy Bridgewater, but their ADOTs are basically the same. They both throw checkdowns at the same rate. Like they're the same player, except for Darnold likes to get out of structure way more. The only problem is he's not actually good when he gets out of structure. Like, yes, you get those plays like against the 49ers in garbage time where he makes an amazing throw, but you also get the dumb interceptions. And he was actually the worst quarterback in the league by EPA outside of the pocket. So if that's the thing you're holding on to, that you can't even hold on to that part of his game.
Yeah, it's literally just the thing. Like, I was talking to somebody a couple of days ago, one of my friends that covers the Panthers, and I was like, yo, if you take Sam Darnold's 10 best throws from his career and you just look at those, you'll be like, oh my God, we just found Patrick Mahomes 2.0.
Right.
But, dude, this place happened like once, like every three games or something like that. Like, it's not like he's just like, obviously, like people, the throw that gets to me all the time. And I was at this game sitting there with my mask on, coronavirus at a Jets game. Oh, gosh. the throw was the 49ers when Darnold like rolled to his left and then fired back. And it was just like a perfect dime to the middle of the field. To Braxton Berrios, I think, for a touchdown to cut the lead from 31-2 to 31-9 or something like that. I'm like, okay, it's like we got a crazy throw, but you know, it took us a lot of slop to even get to this point where, you know, like we're still down by like three touchdowns in the fourth quarter by the time it happens. Like the reason that you're in that spot, like a lot of it has to do with Sam at the same time. So, yeah, like he's really physically talented. But like Steven said, like Joe Flacco was more efficient in this offense. And, you know, Jets fans seem to have run with this idea that Adam Gase was running more explosive plays with Joe Flacco's in the offense. But I don't think that's true. I just think that Joe was just attacking windows that Sam wasn't. I think that Sam had kind of got to this point where it's like, you know, like if you fail enough at something, you're just not going to want to try it that much very often. So he became more and more conservative as the years went along. And like, quite frankly, last year was by far the worst season that he's had in the league, which is saying something because he wasn't exactly lighting things up prior to this season. So, you know, like the Sam Darnold proponents will say, well, look at that 4-game stretch that closes rookie season. And everyone else will be like, well, look at the rest of the sample size. Like,
right.
You know, I get why if you're a Panthers fan, you'll be wanting to talk yourself into this. But it's just kind of crazy to me that based on the reporting, the Panthers are just handing him this job. And I just don't understand the rationale for that. Like, especially, you know, we've talked about like why are the Panthers rushing so much to find this guy? Like, if you had just sat out, if you basically just sat out the 2020 season, you could be walking into, you know, Trevor Lawrence, Justin Fields, Zach Wilson, Trey Lance, if you had wanted to, without needing to trade up. And instead, you know, you panicked and signed Teddy Bridgewater. When you found out he wasn't that good, you panicked and traded for Sam Darnold. And I figure, around this time next year, we're going to have the same conversation, right? Except they don't have a second and a fourth next year. It's like, go up and get whatever quarterback emerges in the draft next year. So, you know, I think that Panthers fans are optimistic because they have to be. And that's
right. Steven and I were talking so much about this last night that, like, people, it's a great sports cliche that you know that consistency is key, right? Like you have to be consistent, you have to play at the same level all the time, but like no one seems to really believe or understand that. So there are these individual throws that Darnold makes and people get excited about it, or individual games. You know, he had this great game against Dallas in 2019 where he completed 71% of his passes for 338 yards, and like people want to point at that, but he was literally 11 for 32 the next week for 86 yards. And like, of course Sam Darnold can do great cool things on a football field. He was a top pick. Like, he's an amazing athlete, but he has shown no ability to do it with any consistency. And that's a huge problem for the Panthers, because like, he's also not going to be bad enough for them to be bad, right? Like, they're just going to be middling again. And that's not how to rebuild.
And he's not better than Teddy Bridgewater. As sad as that is to say, he's never been better than him. The only thing that he does better are those plays that we're talking about that happen once every month. And there's nothing sustainable about him. Like, I was watching, I'm weird, and I went to the Panthers subreddit, and the story was on there. Zero upvotes, by the way, 0 points. A lot of people, not fans of me in that subreddit. But like, I clicked on this all 22 breakdown on YouTube, and it had all the upvotes. So I was already bitter going in. First play, guess what the first play was that they broke down on the all 22? That goddamn play against the 49ers. Like, every time someone talks about Sam Darnold and tries to hype him up, that's the play they point to. And like, that play doesn't matter. It's never going to happen again. Like, why do we care that he did that play? It's a one-off play. I could find every quarterback in the league making a similar play. And no one's – like, you could find Mitchell Trubisky making a crazy play like that.
Right.
And no one's hyped about Mitchell Trubisky because he's become a meme. But for whatever reason – well, actually, I know the reason. It's Adam Gase and his reputation. And the thing about Gase is, like, 2 years ago, no one was considering him like this – quarterback killer who just runs the worst offense of all time. He never had that reputation before. And part of the reason he has it now is because Sam Darnold is not only bad, but he didn't stay healthy. So then we saw Luke Falk playing a lot. And of course your offense is going to look worse when Luke Falk playing. He should have never been in the NFL. So I don't know. There's no reason to think he's good other than the fact that he was picked third overall.
Yeah, it's funny you bring it up, because I was listening to Dan Levitard, and he brought this point. He said in a way that I have been failing to say for a couple of years now. But when you talk about you ask a Jets fan specifically, like, what about Sam Darnold should excite Panthers fans? It's never about Sam Darnold. It's about, oh, you know, Adam Gase wasn't good enough. Oh, they didn't have an offensive lineman until Mekhi Becton got there. Oh, they didn't have any weapons. Oh, you know, the defense wasn't putting them in great situations. Like, it's always about everybody else around Sam Darnold except Sam Darnold himself. Like, and to me, that's a really bad sign, because I feel like we've done this with quarterbacks all the time. Like, I mean, I saw the same arguments for Sam Darnold like that for the years while I was covering the Jets. And it's just like, you know, at some point you have to just come away with the realization, if you're making all these excuses for literally every single person on the team except for Sam, like, at some point some of the blame has to come back on him in his play. And, you know, maybe it works out because he's still like 12 years old, pretty much, and he's going to be walking into he's definitely going to be walking into a more talented offense than he was before. Like, Robbie Anderson as your second best receiver is better than your best receiver, as we saw this year in Carolina, and maybe they can even add someone like Kyle Pitts at number 8 in the draft, depending on how the draft falls. So maybe it can be better, but still, like, you should definitely be a little nervous if you're a Panthers fan.
And that's really one of the issues I have with it, is because he's almost certainly going to be better. And if he is better, if he's like league average in that offense, which I think is possible with Joe Brady calling plays, if Joe Brady is the guy we think he is, and he's average, like, there's going to be this false sense of who he is, and they're going to commit to him long term, and then they're going to be stuck with this average – not even average quarterback, below average quarterback who's being propped up by a supporting cast. And that's just going to set the team back even more than it already is. Like, this is year two of Matt Rhule, and they still haven't rebuilt.
There's no rebuild going on right now.
There's
that's why he was brought in.
There's so many timelines like clashing here. Like I want to say that one thing I think is that if so, Damian actually mentioned this, that Joe Burrow is older than Darnold. If Darnold had been on that LSU team with Joe Brady, he would have looked like Trevor Lawrence, like, right? Like the hype would have been unimaginable because mm-hmm. that team, he would have been better than Joe Burrow. It would have been probably. I mean,
also Joe Burrow is like older than all of us, so that doesn't really count.
Come on now. Let's transition to this Joe Burrow. I mean, this discussion is sort of part of what we're hinting at now. It's like this idea of how best to support and surround a quarterback. But this popped up, and Charles, you wrote about this week. You sort of took a direct look at what the Bengals could do with the number five pick. You know, take Ja'Marr Chase, who everyone thinks seems to be emerging as the top wide receiver, or Penei Sewell, the presumed top left tackle, or trade down. But I want to talk sort of generally about this idea of what would help Joe Burrow more, somebody to protect him or somebody to catch the football.
See, I kind of think that's just in a vacuum. I think that someone to protect him is a little bit more important just because, like, we all saw the way he liked to play at LSU and even his first year in the NFL. Like, he's someone who's going to like to try to extend plays and take chances down the field and try to generate big plays. And, you know, I think if you're someone that's going to try to play a little offbeat, I think the offensive line talent might be a little bit more important than wide receivers talent. Like, obviously, like, getting someone like Ja'Marr Chase is obviously going to help your offense. Duh. No shit. Like, that's going to be something that is beneficial for your team. But I think that one aspect with the Sewell pick that people are kind of underrating is, you know, it's not just like putting Sewell at left tackle. Like, you also have a chance to improve not only just based on the investments that they've made. Like, you have a chance to improve right tackle with Jonah Williams or Riley Reiff, and then one of those guys can play guard. Like, and it's not a foregone conclusion that they would be successful at those different positions, but, you know, it's better than what they've been doing for the past few years, which is basically nothing. I mean, they've trotted out Bobby Hart for a long time, and, you know, when he's not tweeting about QAnon conspiracy theory, he's letting Joe Burrow get sacked. You know, like it's like kind of one of those moves that benefits multiple spots in one pick, which is kind of why I like the Sewell pick. And if they want to be a team that plays a lot of empty to suit Joe Burrow's strength and his comfortability there, you need better offensive line play than they currently have. And I also, like, I don't think their receiver situation is so drastically bad that they need to add like a super alpha right now. I think that that's something you can add in the second or even third round as you start to build out the rest of this roster, because Tyler Boyd, like, I think he's one of the better slot receivers in the league. They just invested in T. Higgins, and I think that he has a promising future as well. Maybe you add another guy early day two to kind of fill that room out after you lose AJ Green to the Cardinals. But just when I think about Joe Burrow's play style, I think that offensive tackle makes the most sense for where they should go. And also, like, Penei Sewell is just an unbelievable draft prospect. I mean, yeah, he showed up at his pro day at Oregon weighing 331 pounds, and he looked like he was like 290, and the way that he was moving, it's crazy. So, I mean, even maybe he could play right tackle too if Jonah Williams doesn't feel comfortable sliding over there. Like, he has the size and the power to do that. So Sewell will be my pick if we just stay there. But as I kind of wrote it and I started thinking about the ideas of what they could do, honestly, trading down and like still staying within like the top 10, 11 picks became something that was like really intriguing to me, because if you're a team like the Bengals and you've decided that, you know, Joe Burrow is going to be our guy, we saw enough that we don't really feel compelled to stay in this rookie quarterback market moving forward, even coming off injury, you know, you're going to be in a situation where it's, you know, quarterbacks are guaranteed to come off the board for the first three picks. And then depending on what Atlanta does, it's probably going to be four quarterbacks. You know, you can trade down a little bit and still have your pick of the litter, basically, of all the elite non-quarterback options, even late in the top 10. I mean, and that's something that is a little bit unusual about this year. And I think that you know, if you're a team that has a quarterback situation figured out, you should be really trying to trade down and trying to get just a couple more picks, because you're still going to have your chance at, you know, even if they trade down, like, let's say they, for the example I brought up was, let's say they trade down with the Broncos to 9. Like, there's still a possibility where you could still have your pick of, like, Kyle Pitts, Jamar Chase theoretically could still be on the board, Devonta Smith, even cornerbacks like Patrick Surtain or J.C. Horn. Like, there's a lot of options that you can go through at 9 just because there can be so many quarterbacks that come off the board to start the draft.
One thing I don't get, if you're drafting a pass catcher, why is Chase the default answer? Like, why aren't you considering Smith? And even more so, why aren't you considering Kyle Pitts? Like, if I'm drafting a pass catcher to help out my quarterback, that's the guy I'm drafting. Yeah.
Right.
Is Kyle Pitts, because he's the best. I think he's the best player in the draft.
But I think it's just like the, you know, lazy bro play the Chase LSU stuff.
That's probably his everything. But, and I think this question about, like, what helps a quarterback more, a receiver who can get open quicker, which I just think is a dumb concept in and of itself, because receivers run routes. They, like, you're not going to get open quicker on a post route, really. To help out your quarterback.
4-2 to 4-4 is not like, you're not really adding that much.
Right. And like the quarterback is throwing on time. So right. It doesn't really matter if you get open quicker. The quarterback's going to throw the ball when he's going to throw the ball. But it just is a simplistic view of football that I don't think is realistic. Like, a good offensive line can help receivers get open because you can keep 5 in to protect. You can get all 5 eligibles out there, and that makes it easier to stretch the defense. Like, if you're playing zone, you need that running back in the flat to create a high-low and put a defender in conflict. Yeah. You can't do that more often when your offensive line stinks and you need to keep that running back or that tight end in to help. And I think that's something that people miss when they're talking about how to help a quarterback get rid of the ball. And specifically with Joe Burrow, his skill set, or his calling card, is his processing ability. Like, I can go from 1 to 2 to 3 and find an open receiver. That's why I don't think needing that alpha dog receiver is really imperative, because if that first receiver isn't open, he has the ability to find number 2, find number 3. Someone's going to get open. The defense can't guard everyone. And the only way he's going to have the time to do that is if he has a good offensive line.
Agree. We've solved it. We did it, guys. Yeah,
it's
over. Figured it out. We figured it out for Cincinnati. I hope they're listening.
Yeah, hire us. I mean, we might
Zach Taylor.
I was about to say, we might be more recognizable than Zach Taylor, to be honest with you.
Oh, man. All right. So we're starting to dig in on some draft stuff next week, right? Is it time? Is it draft season?
I'm ready. Like, I've actually watched I've watched the most players that I've watched since like 2017. So I'm actually ready to kind of get into the discourse for a couple of weeks and then
love it.
Fake being an insider and hop out as soon as this the very second the draft ends, I'll be out. Actually, honestly, I'll probably be out like halfway through round
2. I can't wait to disassociate myself from all my pre-draft takes like I do every year.
You and a bunch of GMs as well. So
I had Josh Rosen QB1 in 2018.
I mean, it's tough, man. It's tough.
To be fair to me, I didn't have all 22, so that's my only draft takes from 2019 on count.
Correct. All right, so we'll start digging in on players at certain positions next week. I think we were probably going to look at wide receivers first, so we'll continue a little bit more of this discourse. So look forward to that. Catch us over at For the Win, ftw.usatoday.com, and on Twitter at the Steven Ruiz, at Forvert, and at Chris Corman. Love to chat with you there. Talk some football. And we will catch up with you next week. Take care.
The Counter, an NFL podcast from USA Today Sports.
Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.